Greetings, listeners. Welcome back to Peace Bound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast brought to you by the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Now, on the show, we discuss stellar runs of Wonder Woman, beginning with the best run of all time, the George Perez written and drawn issues of Wonder Woman from his monumental reinvention of the character in 1987. Now, on each episode, we will have a special guest from the larger podcasting community to help me dive into the issue. Today's guest is faster than a speeding bullet, can leap tall buildings in a single bound, and knows more about Superman than Elliot S. Magan and James Gunn combined. Please welcome to the show, Michael Bailey. Michael, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. I want to say right from the jump, I don't know if I can say I know more than Elliot S. Magan. I probably know more than James Gunn, but he knows way more about indie rock than I ever will. So I think that evens out. But no, thank you so much for having me on. I am very excited. One, because you had me on for this particular issue, but two, so that we can finally get together and chat, just the two of us.
Yeah, I'm super excited. We talked about this off mic, and we have both been on some like jam session episodes for Fire and Water over the years, long before I joined the network, but have never recorded together, much to my lament. And I will admit to you, I shouldn't, because you're going to probably get mad at me for doing this. I'm legitimately nervous about this episode, because I have such reverence for you and your shows, and I've been listening to you. I literally have been in a healthy parasocial relationship with you for so many for over a decade at this point, and literally cannot think of a Superman comic and not think about your coverage of said comic without, you know, so it's like this added layer to my reading experience. And so I am so excited to get to talk to you. And again, especially for this episode and this issue. So I'm so thankful. Thank you so much for being with me today.
No, I generally react like when people compliment me, I tend to turn British all of a sudden, as I joke with Andy, my co-host on the Overlook Dark Knight, all the time. But no, I appreciate that, because I get nervous about years ago, I told Chris Franklin that I was a little intimidated, not by him, like as a person,
yeah,
but just his just general knowledge of things. Yep. It's just like, holy crap. So, and you have dug out a really nice niche with this.
Thank you.
With Perez Wonder Woman run, because I know other people have talked about it, but this is the first show I've actually listened to about it. So there's that too. So,
well, I appreciate that. Yeah, I definitely, in kind of choosing what my show was going to be, my inaugural show for Fire and Water, a good portion of it was I'm just a diehard Perez fan and had always wanted to go back and reread this run, and was like, well, why not pair the two together? And as I'm sure you discovered many, many years ago, when you start covering one character, you know, one book, but especially one character in such detail, you kind of become the like guy, right? Like you are the Superman guy, right? And I would not proclaim I'm the Wonder Woman guy, but I definitely have become more of the Wonder Woman guy than I was a year ago. And I do have people reach out to me and, hey, I'm going to do this issue and Wonder Woman's in it. Do you want to be on it? I'm like, hey, cool. I love that you thought of me. That's really cool. So yeah, there is that fun element to it. And I'm sure, again, I doubly appreciate you being here, because I'm sure you get invitations to be on Superman related episodes like on daily.
Not as often as it used to be, but, you know, because of all the litigation and what are those things called?
The orders of protection.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. The temporary restraining orders and such like that. This year has been insane. Because I like earlier this year, it was just like all of us in the Superman podcasting community were appearing on everybody's shows. Yes.
Which is also, and I love that too. I love that you're on like Digging for Kryptonite, you know, and you know that, you know, you guys all, I love that. That's this whole little sub community within the larger community. I think it's really cool. And I love getting to hear you guys on each other's shows. And, you know, obviously with the movie coming out over the summer, everybody wanted to hear what you thought about, you know, like, I mean, I'm sure you were laughing, because it was like, they wanted to know what you thought about the announcements and then the preview and then the movie, yeah, and then the, you know, reaction to the movie. And you're like, okay, I guess I'm doing six podcasts on this.
Yeah. That's the funny thing, is that I'm a guy that when I staked my claim in podcasting back in 2007, I told myself I'm going to talk about old stuff because keeping up with new stuff was just too much of a full-time job. And when you choose old comics, it's just like, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You can talk about whatever. But this year, it was just like, oh, there's a new trailer. Oh, man, I am going to have to do an episode about that. All right, let's get out the microphone. And thankfully, it was just talking. It wasn't like I had to read 15 issues of something to prep for it. But when everything was said and done in July, I actually went through like a 4 month period of kind of an existential crisis and all that, because everything had been so much building to that. And now it's done. And I'm like, well, crap.
You're like, what's next?
And I've come out on the other side of that. Thankfully, I also lost my website, which sucked.
Yeah.
But I'm rebuilding. And that's also part of the fun. But yeah, it's just, I love that people are now reaching out to you as one of the Wonder Woman people, because that is just, it's just one of those, it's one of those nice little side effects of doing this.
Yeah.
But yeah, when you decide to talk about one character, people will associate you with that. Like, I thought for like 5 seconds, I'm like, I'm not going to podcast about Superman anymore. I'm going to podcast about the Hulk. And then like, I realize I physically can't do that on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Because everyone associates me with Superman.
I mean, it's an automatic. It really is. It really is. Yeah. I mean, and look, I would love to have you. I mean, I love Overlooked Dark Knight. You know, I love the, you know, when you talk about other characters and, you know, all your shows, but it is, I mean, you will always be, you know, it, I mean, it is funny because I'll listen to Overlooked Dark Knight and I'm like, oh, Superman and Spider-Man are talking about Batman. You know, like, this is great. That,
Andy and I will be talking about Superman and Spider-Man teaming up a lot this year.
Actually. Oh, yeah. Yeah. You'll have some grist for that mill this year. That's awesome. That's great. So yes, very thankful that you're here. Super excited to talk about this issue. Now, before we jump into the episode, the Fire and Water Podcast Network brings hours of amazing content to the airwaves each month, and we needed some help running the network and hosting our shows, so we started a Patreon. At certain tiers of support, you can sponsor a show, and I'd like to thank Martin Gray, Darren Appel, and Brett Young for choosing to sponsor Peace Bound and Down. If you're interested in joining our Patreon, please visit patreon.com/fireandwaterpodcastnetwork. So, Michael, I begin every episode by asking the same question of the guest. What is your history with Wonder Woman? How'd you first discover the character?
The Super Friends. I'm part of that generation. And to a lesser extent, the Linda Carter show, I was a little too young to watch it new.
Mm-hmm.
Just because, you know, it premiered in 75 and I was born in 76. So there's that. I'm not like some people, Chris Franklin, that like walked out of the womb having read like 15 comics while I was in there and watched all the shows. But I did catch some of that like in syndication, but it was really the Super Friends. I had her superpowers figure.
Oh, that's awesome.
Got that 40 years ago this past Christmas, as a matter of fact. And as far as the comics, I have a very fond memory of reading the first three parts of Challenge of the Gods from a 3-pack I found at KB Toys.
Nice.
When I was like 12 years old, because they like sold 3-packs of comics that had like trading cards you cut out.
Uh-huh.
And I read those books and I really liked them, but I didn't have a lot of money. So it wasn't like I was going to keep buying it, unfortunately. But in 97, I decided I was going to buy all of the main titles of the JLA members.
Oh, nice.
So that's when I started collecting the Burn Run and then worked my way backwards. So.
Oh, cool. Okay. And it's funny that Burn Run, it's not everybody's favorite, and there's definitely a couple of missteps. See Donna Troy for the third time. But I have great fondness for that run. One, I love Byrne's art. And two, I love that he makes Hippolyta the Wonder Woman of World War II. Like, I think Polly is a great character choice. So he did a lot well there, too.
It's one of those things where anybody who talks about anything involving Byrne in comics is just like, yeah, I love this, except, or,
oh, yeah,
but.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, he gave us the new Wonder Girl.
Yep, Cassie Sandmore.
She is not that character at all anymore.
No.
But, you know, that is where she first appeared. And yeah, it was that whole, Wonder Woman was one of those titles in the late 90s that was like where they hid the JSA.
Yeah.
Until the series in 99, after Zero Hour. It's just like Starman became a refuge.
Yep.
And Wonder Woman did, and The Flash by Mark Wade, and Green Lantern. So it was nice to see her mixing it up with that. It was weird, don't get me wrong. It was a convoluted way to get where we got. But
oh, yeah.
It was nice that it happened.
No, it's good. And it's funny because you're right. Byrne is the great. He's a 90-10 creator, right? I mm-hmm. love 90% of what he does on a run. But that 10%, that, you know, destroying the vision in Avengers West Coast and, you know, Donna Troy and the ham-handed way he tries to retcon her when there was no need. I mean, definitely a solution in search of a problem, you know, but at the same time, Mount Rushmore. I mean, just, you know, if you're gonna look at 80s comics forward, 70s comics forward, and, you know, especially for art, he is definitely amongst them. And you know, and again, has a very pronounced and very Burnsian relationship with Superman, right? Comes in, helps relaunch the book with Man of Steel, helps really set the tone for post-crisis Superman. And then, to my knowledge, and you might correct me on this, leaves in a huff when he doesn't get enough attention for Superman's 50th. Is that, am I representing that correctly?
There's a little more to it than that. I think he just got one. I don't know if he'd ever admit to this. I think he got burned out, because no pun intended there. Because really, when you look at it, he was on the book from July of 86 to July-ish of 88, but he did like 5.5 years worth of comics in that time period. And I don't know if you know this, but he has a bit of a thing where he wants to be in charge.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because DC wasn't giving him the support in terms of merchandising.
Oh, interesting.
And other things, because he's said in interviews that Dick Giordano said, you got to realize there's a Superman we merchandise, and then there's a Superman you do in the comics.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he just, he now says he wishes he never did it, which
that's interesting.
A whole other kettle of fish. But I always, the biggest thing about doing From Crisis to Crisis was realizing that I used to think, I'm a Byrne Superman fan. And then I realized, that's what brought me in. That's mm-hmm. what got me into the door. But it's really the people who built on the foundation that he laid. That's my Superman. So it's so weird.
No, it's funny that you say that, because I had the exact same realization. And in part, it may have been osmosis, because I did a reread in listening to your show. And I reread Man of Steel. And the same thing, went in saying, like, you know, Byrne's a top five Superman creator. Like, they owe a ton to Byrne. And I don't disagree with the magic he brought and the mm-hmm. verve he brought to the relaunch. But if you sit me down, my favorite Superman stories of all time follow his run. It's Superman Exile. It's mm-hmm. that first Mongol post-crisis war world, you know, wearing the fetish leather, you know, outfit, you know, and the beard, which was a whole other kind of awakening for some of us. But, it's Stern and Ordway and Gamut and, you know, and Cary Gamble and, you know, Dan Jurgens. That's actually mm-hmm. my pocket. And it's funny because I did the exact same thing. I attribute a lot of that shine to Byrne, and he does deserve a lot of credit because he lays the groundwork for it. But it is, I don't know if I'm the only person, but I argue that Roger Stern is one of the maybe five greatest comic writers of all time. I mean, best Avengers run, best Doctor Strange run, one of the best Amazing Spider-Man runs, one of the best Superman runs, great Legion run. Captain America, great Legion run during the Archie Legion. So I'm a big Stern guy, and so I love his Superman run.
I love that term, Archie Legion. I love it so much. I love how we as fans have these cute little nicknames.
What's so funny is I'm a huge Legion fan. I'm a diehard Legion fan. And so when they rebooted for Zero Hour, I was really upset because I felt like I felt like everybody felt in crisis who was collecting comics mm-hmm. way before I was, right? I loved Crisis. I loved the energy it brought, and I really didn't have issue with many of its changes. And I felt like all the people who did were old man yelling at clouds. And then I was the old man yelling at clouds after Zero Hour, because I was like, my Legion is gone, you know? I actually did not give the Archie Legion a chance. I did not read the Legion again until the Wade Kitson 3 boot.
Mm.
20 or not, but like 10 years later at least. And it was actually during the pandemic, right as the pandemic was starting, when we kind of started to understand what it was going to be, my local comic book store was like, look, we're going to shut down for a while. And they ended up shutting down permanently, but they're like, look, we're going to shut down for a while. So we are unloading books at unheard of. And I was able to get the entire Archie Legion run, both Legionnaires and Legion. at like 15 cents an issue.
Ooh.
Yeah. And I was like, well, I can't pass that up. Right. So I bought it in bulk. I bought the whole thing. And then as a little fun project during the pandemic, read it. And it is now my favorite Legion era ever. So, you know, mea culpa. But it's funny, you know, and I love, like you said, when you host shows about older comics and older characters, there's the joy of perspective and the joy of looking back. And so, listeners, this is a very special episode, not only because Michael's with us, but because we are not, in fact, covering an issue of George Perez's amazing Wonder Woman run, but instead we are covering the post-crisis first meeting, but first date, question mark, first interaction between Superman and Wonder Woman in Action Comics 600, which is the 50th anniversary of Superman. The issue is titled Different Worlds. It has script and layouts by John Byrne, finished art by George Perez. It's letters by John Stanza, colors by Tom Zucco, and it is edited by Mike Carlin. And it was released in May of 1988, and it sets the tone for the greatest love story.
Actually wasn't released in May. It was released in February.
In February, yes.
And the reason why I know this is I'm a leap baby.
Oh, nice.
And that was my 12th birthday in 1988. And my sister Mary got me Action 600, the third issue of World of Smallville, and a tape with three episodes of the Fleischer Superman shorts on them.
Oh, that is a great sister.
So that's this issue could have ended up being hot garbage and I still would have loved it for the rest of my life because of that memory. But thankfully it did not turn out to be hot garbage.
No, not at all.
But yeah, that I love how you phrase that. First date, maybe?
yeah, first interaction. We'll definitely talk about that opening interaction because it is – Byrne and Perez don't shy away from the awkwardness of it, which I actually really love. So I guess listeners, as you all know, before we jump into the issue proper – we begin every episode with a segment I like to call the Lasso of Truth, in which the guest and I each grab Diana's magic lasso and share one silly truth about ourselves. Now, Michael, since you're the guest, why don't you go first?
I once helped a madam decide if she was going to have sex with somebody for $750.
Okay, wow. Gauntlet thrown. Okay, please go on.
So, 1997... I worked third shift at a gas station because I dropped out of college, stay in school, kids. And I worked third shift. And Fayetteville, Georgia is not like a hotbed of anything at 3 o'clock in the morning. But occasionally weird stuff would happen. And one night, someone came in. She bought a couple of Black and Milds and then went back out of her car. She looked at me through the window, looked at her car, looked at me and walked back in. And I'm like, oh, crap.
Yeah.
And she goes, and I don't... Do I have to sanitize this?
No, you're fine.
Okay. She goes, can I ask you a question? I'm like, sure. And I learned really fast, never just say sure. She goes, okay, I got three women f***ing at my house right now. Now, you can call me a madam, you can call me anything you want, but I got three women f***ing at my house right now for $750 each. I'm getting $250 each off of them. And I got this other guy that wants to f*** me for $750. Now, here's the problem. And I'm like... My mind at this point is reeling. She goes, here's the problem. I used to hang out with this girl. See, me and my husband, who's off probably f***ing right now, and that's okay because that's what we do. But we go to strip clubs and we try to find girls to work for us. And I got to be really good friends with this one girl. And this one girl had a guy that she loved, but he never thought of her as anything but a trick. But she loved him. And then she and I stopped talking because we got in a fight because I was hanging out with this other girl. But the guy that wants to f*** me for $750 is the guy that she liked. And I'm wondering if I should do this.
Wow.
What should I do? And I'm like, so this is where I learned at 21 to be very noncommittal in an answer.
Yeah.
And what I told her was, I go, okay, so you got three girls f***ing at your house right now for $750 each and you're getting $250. Yeah, you can call me madam. I'm like, yeah. She repeated that phrase, by the way, 15 times.
That's so funny.
I'm like, so you're making $750 for doing nothing.
Already, literally. Yeah.
And she's like, yeah. And I'm like, now, you're not friends with this girl now, but will you ever be friends with her again? And she's like, maybe. I go, if you f*** this guy for $750 and she finds out about that, could that screw that up? Man, I didn't think about that. Thanks a lot. And she left.
Wow. I mean... I have my mouth is agape. I think this is the first time I've been this shocked since Dr. Ange's story about taking calculus on behalf of a girl to try to impress her. That is amazing. Did you ever, I mean, did she ever come back?
Nope. For more advice? Never saw her again. never saw her again. I hope she's living her best life. But it's just, that's the thing about Third Shift is that people are out that aren't normally interacting with other human beings. So
that is an amazing story. First of all, this the madam of it all, the you know, sisters before misters at the heart of the question is brilliant. But I love the fact that you're like, I'm just some dude working third, and you know, and anybody, and I actually coincidentally, my Lasso of Truth moment is gonna happen on Third Shift as well. Anybody who's ever worked that shift knows you see a cross section of humanity that most people don't know exists. I mean, it is the upside down, you know, it is whatever you want to call it. It is a layer of humanity that most people don't get to see. And there's some beauty in that. And then there are some moments like your story where you are giving advice to a madam. That is brilliant. Oh, my God.
I mean, some nights it's that. Some nights it's Emmanuel Lewis coming in and buying a Coke because he lives in the area. So I saw him in the Iron Sheik on the regular at like 2 o'clock in the morning.
Well, I have to say, Michael, I definitely did not have Webster, the Iron Sheik, and a madam on my bingo card for this episode, but that is the best. That is just the best story ever. I you really brought it. So my story nowhere near as impactful. Also, actually takes place on Third Shift, and I've talked about this before. But I lived in Seattle after college. I went to school at Arizona State, and then moved to Seattle for a little while after college, and I paid my way through college as a pharmacy technician. So when I moved to Seattle, it was really easy to get a job as a pharmacy tech. So I did that so I could, you know, make a living while moving into a new city. And I worked in downtown Seattle at a 24-hour pharmacy, and you had to do rotating shifts. And there were, you know, you would do a week of third shift and then a week off and all that kind of fun stuff for anybody who's ever worked retail. Now, I've told this part of the story before, so this isn't the story, but this particular pharmacy was right up the street from Key Arena, where the Seattle Supersonics used to play. So we used to get basketball players coming in with women after games all the time. It was a methadone dispensary. So we would dispense methadone at all crazy hours of the night, which is always its own fun thing. And it was the pilot Plan B program, the birth control program for the entire country. So it was a hotbed of very, very interesting people. And so this particular story takes place there because if you've ever worked in any medical capacity, even something as kind of innocuous as a a pharmacy chain pharmacy tech. So, you know, it's basically like a Walgreens. It was like Seattle's, it's called Bartels. It's Seattle's version of Walgreens. And I'm just a kid. I'm like 21 years old. And I am a pharmacy tech. I do have a test I took. That's it. I'm not a pharmacist. I'm certainly not a doctor. And I do have the white coat on, but it's only because they bought those in bulk. So everybody who works in the pharmacy wears the white coat. But when you wear a white coat, you realize that there are people who will ask and show you anything because they think you are a medical professional. So this particular night, I'm on third shift. And I'm working with an older pharmacist who is very, very angry that he still has to work third shift because he's really close to retiring. So he will go into the back and sleep. There's a cot in the back. And he trusts me / doesn't care and lets me just run the show overnight the whole night. And so when people say like, oh, you know, can I take this with such and such? 9 out of 10 times, I know the answer. So I'll give the answer. If I don't know it and I'm really worried, I'll go back and ask him. But more often than not, I'm okay. But at one point, I need to step outside to get a drink of water really quick and just to grab a soda to keep me awake. So I tell the pharmacist, hey, you know, I'm going to step outside for a second. He's like, ah, that's fine. And he's still back at the cot. So I step outside and this older gentleman walks up to me and he says, are you the pharmacist? And I go, I'm as close as you're getting tonight. What's up? And he goes, well, I have this thing and I'm worried about it, but I don't know what I should do. And I go, oh, well, in that case, hold. And before I can even kind of turn my head, he has unzipped his pants, has dropped his pants and underwear, and is holding his genitalia in his hand. And I go, oh my God. I go, what are you doing? And he goes, no, do you see this? And I go, yes, I see it. And he goes, no, look. He goes, look, do you see this? And I go, yes. He goes, what does this look like to you? And I go, your penis. I go, please put it away. Please, please put it away before somebody else is forced to see it as well. And he goes, no, not that. He goes, the thing on my penis, which I have to admit stops me in my tracks. And I look and he goes, do you see it? And I go, I guess. And he goes, what does it look like? And I go, Garfield? And he goes, no. He goes, medically, what does it look like? And I go, dude, I don't know. I need you to put your junk back in your pants. And I'm just going to need you to leave the store. Like, what you have done is technically illegal. Also, there are videotape, like, there are cameras everywhere. What you have done has just been captured on tape. I'm not calling the cops on you. I don't think you meant anything, you know, any ill intent, but I need you to leave. I've seen enough, more than enough of you for tonight. So I see him beeline to the front of the store, to the manager. And I'm kind of new at this job. I kind of moved to Seattle somewhat recently, and I'm a little worried, like, oh, if this guy complains, am I going to lose my job? And I'm worried about it. So I'm watching closely as he's, you know, talking to the manager, until I see the manager go, whoa, put that away, and then point to the door and send the guy out of this. And I was like, oh, okay, I'm safe, because he also showed the manager his junk. So yeah, so what I learned that evening is a lesson I learned many times in that pharmacy, which is if you wear a white coat, people will pretty much show you or tell you anything. And yeah, you know, we should really, I bet you were not alone in this. I bet if we polled our little podcasting community, we could do like a 4-part Legends of the Third Shift series.
Yeah. Oh God. Yes.
Where we had, yeah, we could talk about some funky moments at our jobs.
You mentioned that I was in Seattle. So as this whole story was playing, I was hearing Dyslexic Heart from the single soundtrack. I don't know why. It just felt like it. I don't know if this was the early 90s. It could have been another time period, but still.
it was the late 90s. So, you know, more sort of just coming out of grunge, but still.
Yeah.
Still, the perfect soundtrack to that moment in my life. So, listeners, that's that's an all-time Lasso of Truth moment. I am still very much thinking about you. Like, dude, I'm just trying to sell lottery tickets and gas. Yeah. Like, I don't need to be giving you life advice, but that is hilarious. So, we'll jump into the issue itself. So this is Action Comics 600. Now, it is an 80-page giant in the mm-hmm. tradition of DC 80-page giants. We are only covering the Action Comics portion of it, which is a crossover between Wonder Woman and Superman, and is the payoff to a couple of months buildup in their own books about them fantasizing, is probably the right verb, about their first meeting together and wanting to meet up again. And this meeting has been arranged. So since our first meeting in Washington, D.C. months ago, which is over a year ago, our time in Legends number 6, Superman and Wonder Woman have been having really intense sort of dreams about each other. They've been fantasizing about each other. They've been thinking about each other. And we talked about this on last episode with Ross Aitken. There's a 4-page dream sequence to open that issue of Wonder Woman, issue 15. And her version is a bit more innocent than Kansas farm boy Clark Kent's dream in his own book, but is still pretty provocative. And she is, in particular, really troubled by it because she has no experience with romance with men. Now, I say that very specifically because one of the best retcons, I think, in DC Comics history is the acknowledgement that Diana grew up on Paradise Island, which does not preclude her from having had many loves and many romances with women, but she's never had one with a man. So, you know, understandably confusing. Men are confusing. We're a superstitious and criminal lot. So Superman and Wonder Woman arrange a time to meet privately, and the issue opens with Superman kissing her passionately with Diana, eyes wide open, clearly caught off guard. The two separate, Superman apologizes, they admit they've been thinking about each other, and they agree to fly off and have a first date. Before they can get to know each other, before they can get far at all, Diana is called to Olympus by a frantic Hermes who has been imprisoned, which we'll learn later, is by the great bad of the DC Universe, Darkseid. She flies to Olympus through a portal, Superman follows. On Olympus, they discover that Darkseid and Desaad have taking control of Olympus, kind of, sort of. They get into fights with what they think are each other, but are actually others in disguise. It leads into a fight between the two of them, or does it? They confront Darkseid. They confront Desaad. Diana uses the power of words to send Darkseid away, and they part as friends with a fun little acknowledgement by Clark saying, you know, I actually think you're out of my league. I'm just a simple farm boy from Kansas, and you're much, much more than that. But they decide to part as friends. So a fun issue that we'll talk about in a lot more detail. But let's start at the cover. So, Michael, you're our guest. Why don't you describe the cover for the listeners and tell us your thoughts on it?
So it has 80-page giant on it in the old 80-page giant logo, typeface, whatever you want to call that. And it's set up like that. So you have in the middle a really cool gold statue of Superman, fists on hips and all that, commemorating Superman's golden anniversary, 1938 to 1988. We have Superman's romance with Wonder Woman, where we see them kissing. Superman's stalemate with Lex Luthor, which is a lie because the two of them never see each other in this issue. He's slamming his fist on the table. It looks like Lois has had too much to drink and Jimmy is calling them a ride home, but that's not what happens either. With Superman's pals, Lois Lane and Jimmy Olsen, and Superman's conflict with the Man-Bat.
His great archenemy.
So it's like, I look at that Jimmy Olsen and Lois Lane part of it, and I'm like, that represents nothing. I mean, I get it that they're taking artwork from inside the issue and putting it on the cover, which kind of a cheat.
Yes.
In all honesty. I feel bad because I read your notes before I typed up my notes, and I think we are on the same page with this, whereas on a nostalgic level, I love this, but I really think they should have gone with the one that was on the inside.
Yes.
Of Superman and Wonder Woman kissing with Apocalypse and Earth, and it's just such a more dynamic cover.
Yeah, this is, I think you and I are on the same page. I can acknowledge the nostalgia goggles they were going for on this, of like, oh, hey, we don't do these 80-page giants the way we did in the 50s and 60s and 70s. Let's refer back to them by having a lot of stuff on the cover and you know, showing how many different stories we're going to cover. And not accidentally, showing a little art that's clearly Byrne, showing a Kurt Swan face, right, for the old heads who mm-hmm. love Kurt Swan, showing what is clearly a Mike Mignola piece of Superman, again, fighting Man-Bat for some reason. That part still confounds me. And then this big gold statue in the middle. I would rather it were just the gold statue and everything else gone, you know, just this iconic mm-hmm. image, or better chosen, the really dynamic Byrne and Perez cover on the first page when you open it, of Diana and Superman kissing over the Earth with Apocalypse sort of invading in the background. This is not a great cover. This is not a memorable cover. I mean, if you ask me, I don't know, my 150 favorite Superman covers ever, I don't know that this makes the list. I mean, I just really think, I think it's cute and I get what they're going for, but it feels very paced up. It feels mm-hmm. like, you know, Joe in the art department, you know, got Burns notes at the last minute and was like, whatever, man, I'm just going to paste some things on and they're going to have to live with it. So all in all, not really the best celebration of Superman's 50th year.
Yeah, I mean, like, from a distance, it probably looked good on the stands. This was in the very, very early days of me collecting the Superman books, so I liked everything.
Yeah.
you like everything when you're 11, 12 years old.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just like, I wouldn't consider this, you said one of the 150, it's like, it's not even like the best Byrne cover. It's
not even close. Yeah.
And I'm not saying that to, like, trash on it. It's just you had a better option, and you didn't use it.
Yeah.
And yeah. I think that's where the disappointment lies.
They should have reversed it. They should have had the Superman Wonder Woman cover mm-hmm. as the main cover. And then when you open it, this cute little page of, oh, hey, here's what's inside. You know, that even would have been a better plan. But no, instead they go with a really just uninspiring, you know, 50th anniversary cover. And I'm glad you feel this way, because even in my notes, I think I hint to, like, oh, I'm going to be in the minority here. But,
no, not at yeah. all.
But I do not love this cover at all. So let's dive into the issue. And so the opening splash page of the actual story, Superman, then this is continuing off of Superman and Wonder Woman encountering each other in the last mm-hmm. issue of his series. And he goes right in for a kiss. And this is just beautiful, brilliant storytelling by Byrne and Perez, where he's kissing passionately. She's lip locked, but her eyes are open in panic. Like, what the hell is happening right now? And instead of having her eyes open in panic and then immediately they separate, boy, do they linger on this moment for one full splash page and then three panels at the top of page two before Superman goes, uh-oh, I misread this moment, and step back. So what are your thoughts on the choice to have this moment go so wrong so fast?
I'm kind of glad it did, because like I can't think of this issue without thinking of Adventures of Superman 440, where is Superman getting ready to go on the date, basically.
Yeah.
He's like, ah, it's almost like he's listening to, like, Saturday Night Fever as he's getting dressed. And it's like, and that issue is like the culmination of like 15 subplots.
Yeah.
Involving a scrapbook, which ironically, the scrapbook subplot started in the very issue where Superman has his very intense dream, which you're right. It is so much more intense and still chased for sure. Modern audiences. But when they see each other, he goes, "At last," and they kiss, and it looks very, you know, it's Jerry Ordway, so it looks very romantic. And then you get to this issue and it's like, oh, this is awkward.
Yes. And it looks like she's reciprocating in that issue. And then you open this page and you're like, oh, there's no. She's not pulling away, but she's definitely not. I mean, her eyes are wide open. Like, what is happening in the moment? And I do want to draw really specific attention to the dialogue. Because he's Superman. He's Clark Kent. He's a good dude. Like all people, he misread a moment. And he's like, I am so sorry. And he apologizes immediately. He's like, I guess I've been building this up in my head. I think I thought this was something it wasn't. I'm really sorry. Clearly you don't feel the same way. And she's like, well, I won't say that I don't feel the same way. And I also have had thoughts, so I just don't have a lot of experience. But I have been thinking about you. And then he says to her, and I'm like, oh, Clark, there's no need to be this honest. He says, you must have stronger mental self-control than I do, Wonder Woman. I've thought of you often. I even had a rather intense dream about you shortly after Washington. And I'm like, dude, we need to call JLA HR in because you don't tell your coworker that you had the erotic dream. You have it. You have embarrassment about it. You blush when you see them the next day. And then you stuff it way down in your brain where you'll never think about it again. You do not come out and say, I had a rather intense dream about you. I love, is that do you like that moment because it's revelatory of who Clark is, or is it more cringy than anything?
Okay, so this gets into how I think sometimes Byrne went weird.
Yeah.
With something involving Superman, because at one point he says, I'm not good at this sort of thing. And I'm like, dude, like 3 months ago, Cat Grant was at your apartment making you dinner.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, to quote Chris Rock, it was the next morning she was wearing your shirt and she was making you eggs. We all know what happened.
So it's not like you're bad at romance. I mean, you dated Lana in high school.
Yeah, Lori Lamaris. Yeah.
And then completely treated her like crap during the rest of Byrne's run.
Yeah.
That's a whole other conversation. And then, like, dude, stop. Just if you kissed her because you built this up in your mind that it was something that it wasn't. That happens to people. Mm-hmm. And I get it. And nowadays somebody going right in for the kiss is not as socially acceptable.
Right.
As it was in 1988. I mean, in 1988, grabbing a woman and just kissing her was considered, stating your intentions, where now it requires law enforcement to get involved. But don't tell her of the, and it wasn't, okay, to be fair, it's not the most intense dream because it was a comic book in 1987.
Yes, it doesn't matter.
But still, dude.
you don't bring it up.
You're absolutely right. You don't go, like, you've just met her, like, you fought alongside each other. Maybe you saw each other across the room during Millennium, but no one wants to talk about Millennium, so you're just going to not count that. Oh, God, everything about this opening thing is awkward.
And look, it's well done in its awkwardness. They don't, to their credit, they don't shy away from the awkwardness, which I love. And actually, which brings me to my first secret question of the episode. So Superman makes an assumption that he and Wonder Woman are going to link up romantically. He misreads the situation, goes in for a kiss. She does not reciprocate. In any medium, Michael, so it can be movies, TV, comics, anything. What is your favorite awkward romantic moment or scene between characters?
This was difficult because I watched a lot of television in the 80s. And it's just like, it's almost like flooding the zone with this sort of thing. And it wasn't awkward for the characters. But when I watched it again as an adult, I was just like, oh, this is a similar thing, something you don't say to a coworker. There was an episode of Night Court where it was the Halloween episode from one season where Harry started dating a witch.
Okay.
Now, I realize now that this was formative in other ways, considering my wife is pagan. so maybe that's why it stands out. But it doesn't work out because she's like weird and he's a judge and it might look bad. So he breaks it off and he's depressed at the party that he goes to. And Christine, played by Marky Post, is there dressed as a witch. And she's just like, are you feeling bad? He goes, yes, but that outfit you're wearing is really helping with that. And I, when I watched it as a teenager, I went, yeah. But I watched it again as an adult. I'm like, oh my God, why did you say that out loud?
Yeah, you're her boss.
So.
Oh my God.
That would be, I am going to turn around and do a secret question to you.
Oh, okay.
Based on the artwork in this first couple of pages, the cape on Superman droops low in the back.
Okay.
And that is a nod to the Adventures of Superman television series from the 50s. I don't know how familiar you are with that show.
Uh-huh. I use somewhat.
But which Lois from that series Ooh. Do you prefer, and why is it Phyllis Coates?
Was she the second Lois?
She's the first. She's the one from the first season. And then Noelle Neal comes for the rest of the series.
Okay, yeah. I'm a Noelle Neal. I'm a later. Yeah, it's same, you know, same with Bewitched, you know, the Darren, second Darren's better than the first. Yeah, I like them both, but I think I just had more time with Noelle Neal. I think those are the episodes I caught more. So in my mind, she was Lois. And when I would catch episodes with the other actors, I was like, well, who is this? So it may even just be a timing thing of when I encountered mm-hmm. it. But yeah, no, she imprinted on me way, way, way more than the other.
Now I have a thing of Kristen Stewart coming out going, you imprinted on Sean?
Oh, God. Yeah, we really did lose that word for a good, like, 5 years.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh. So it sounds like you are definitely a fan of original flavor, original
recipe?
Oh,
God, yes. Oh, my God. See, but that has to go with the fact that I prefer the first season just in general.
Yeah.
I do not care, ultimately, for how silly the later seasons got. And that's just because of how I am as a Superman fan.
Yeah.
I'm an omnivore. I'll consume just about every Superman media. But I have a very specific version that I like.
So actually, so this is not a secret question I had ready, but in any medium, who is your favorite Lois and who was the Lois you were most attracted to?
Ooh, my favorite Lois is Bitsy Tulloch.
Okay.
Superman and Lois did a number on me as a show. It is my favorite version of Superman in live action. Tyler Hoechlin.
Yes.
Shockingly became my favorite Superman.
Yeah.
And Bitsy just embodied that. Who was I most attracted to? Dana Delaney.
Oh, wow.
And
wow. Okay.
This is embarrassing. This is something you admit because I was 20 when this happened. But, you know, that show premiered in Superman, the animated series premiered in 1996 in September. Right before that, HBO showed like every night Exit to Eden.
Oh, with
Rosie O'Donnell and Dan Aykroyd and Dana Delaney. So yeah. I know some because I never watched China Beach.
I love China Beach. Yeah.
It was just one of those. Weirdly, it was a show my mom didn't watch. And like all of those types of shows that I watched when I was a kid, I watched with my mom. Mm-hmm. So I didn't watch China Beach, but I watched a crap load of Sisters.
I did too.
So I read like somebody named Dana Delaney is going to be in the Superman show as Lois Lane. Oh, this is a movie with Dana Delaney in it. Maybe I'll get an idea of what she's like. And you really do.
You do.
So
you very
it's
much
kind of
do.
Embarrassing. Now, to be fair, she's great in that movie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That movie is like better than it has any right to be. but I think just like on like just being like attracted in a very chaste and like respectful way.
Sure.
You know, because it's not like there's been any Lois that's quote unquote ugly. So
no. I mean, yeah, no, not at all. I my most attracted to answer is not going to put me out on any limbs. I mean, Terry Hatcher is maybe one of the sexiest women in the history of the universe. And, you know, and just was Lois Lane and was amazing. And she's not my favorite Lois, but she is, I think the sexiest Lois of all time. I mean, my favorite Lois, and this is just, you know, speaking of imprinting, you know, Margot Kidder is just always going to be Lois Lane for me. And even though I don't necessarily in retrospect love the like franticness of Kidder, I like my Lois Lane much more. Like, I don't need Clark. I don't need Superman. I'm a badass on my own. I could carry my own comic for 300 issues. You'd all love it. I do love Kidder's, like, I'm going to throw myself off this building and you're going to catch me. And I'm going to, you know, again, HR violation. I'm going to force this romance on you. So, you know, again, two predictable answers, but I think for men of a certain age, probably the two more common ones.
I mean, Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman was a thing, a whole thing. Like, I remember I was a senior in high school when that premiered and I was sitting in class like late in the year, and one of the people that I'd known for, you know, coming up in junior high and high school with, she saw I was reading a Superman comic in study hall. I know that shocks everybody. And she's like, oh, I watched Lois and Clark. And I looked at her like I had seen her for the first time.
Yes.
And I was about to ask a question and I went, you think Dean Cain is hot, don't you? And she went, yeah. And I'm like, okay. This is so it had a wide variety of fans.
Oh yeah. No. It appealed to every, the male gaze, the female gaze, and every gaze in between. I mean, yeah, that show knew where its bread was buttered and did not shy away from it. No, it's, I mean, but you know, and I just, you know, I really love, like in comic books, I love when Lois, this is actually, and I talked about this weirdly enough on the last episode with Ross Aiken, I love when Lois interacts with Batman without Superman, because it reminds you what a badass she is. Because Bruce will look at Lois and go, oh, that's my equal. Like, she's not, I don't need to protect her. I don't need to shelter her, shepherd her. She is my equal in every way. She's probably smarter than I am. And in fact, I'm going to lean into her when I need help digging into something. And so I don't know, I love when Lois is like Superman's the cherry on top of the Lois sundae. Like, she's just fine on her own. I mean, I do love them together, but I think she's such a strong character. But yeah, I mean, that's she's great.
I do have to mention this because if you talking about that, there is a moment in the Tom Taylor John Kent Superman run where Batman shows up at the farm and he knocks on the door. And John Kent's like, you actually knocked on the door? And Lois is in the background like, yeah, he didn't do that once, and he's never going to do it again.
Yes, that is. So I have three very, very favorite moments. Like, that's one of them. I love the moment where Bruce shows up at Lois and Clark's, and they have Earl Grey tea for him. And he goes, you drink Earl Grey? And they go, no, but Alfred sends it to any place you might go so that it's available for you. And it's like this beautiful little how much Alfred loves him moment. And then I love. And I don't remember what, this is like the very beginning of the Philip Kennedy Johnson, or very end of it, of his run, when Superman's back on Earth and everybody's over at the Kents for like game night, family game night. And John goes, oh, I'll run into the closet and grab, you know, Boggle or Sari or whatever. And he opens the closet door and there's Clark's War World like leather strap outfit. And he goes, hey, Mom, how come you guys saved the – and he just stops and she closes the door and she's like, any more – and he's like, nope. And she just walks and he walks off. It's so great. I love that moment. I love that moment. I love when they give them, you know, a robust relationship. It's awesome. So so just to circle back really quickly, my favorite klutzy romance, I'm going to go to TV – it's still on TV. I haven't watched it in probably 12 years, but Grey's Anatomy, the first 4 years of that show are unassailable as pure soap opera brilliance. And the whole, for anybody who watched Grey's Anatomy in the beginning, the whole MacGuffin of that show is Meredith Grey is a young doctor. She's moved back to her mom's hometown in Seattle. She's going to start her residency. The night before, she meets a guy at a bar. They sleep together. Next day, turns out that's the doctor. That's her resident. It's Patrick Dempsey. And then they have an will they, won't they thing for about a year. Season one or season two, I don't remember which one, ends with them finally like, yep, we're going to do this. And in walks a woman who goes, get your hands off my husband. And it's all just the soap opera dialed to 11. And it is brilliant and wonderful and beautiful. And we lost something as a country. We used to be a proper country. We used to have like super steamy soap operas. And I think we should have them back. So Michael, we get the really awkward moment of Clark and Wonder Woman kissing. Wonder Woman is incredibly gracious and says to him, hey, I'm not looking to consummate, but could we maybe have a first date? And he's like, yeah, that'd be awesome. Let's go flying together. And then this is where Byrne and Perez are like, okay, enough drama. Let's get to the punchy punchy. And there's a portal in the sky. They're taken to Olympus. The one thing I do really love about the Olympus that's depicted is it's the Olympus of the Wonder Woman comic.
Yes.
Yeah, because the laws of physics do not apply. There's no, like, you can be upside down. It's M.C. Escher. The gods can navigate it. Darkseid and Desaad can navigate it. But anybody less than a god is completely turned around. And then you can tell where Byrne and Perez split the art duties here, because it's all Perez backgrounds. I mean, the man never met a piece of rubble he didn't love to draw.
Yeah.
And it is beautifully depicted. And we get Superman and Wonder Woman separated, and we learn that it's Darkseid and Desaad behind it all. So what were your thoughts when you realized who the big bad was of the issue?
When I was a kid, I was just like, ooh, Darkseid, I have his superpowers figure, and I watched him on TV. So this is before I really was familiar with him in the comics, and it's definitely before I had my awakening as a Kirby fan.
Yeah.
In fact, I wrote an essay about that is in a book called Jack of All Trades.
Nice.
Which is a bunch of essays about Jim Beard edited that and invited me to come out and play again. And I basically talked about how I learned to love Kirby basically through the New Gods. You would think it would have been through like the Hulk or, you know, the Fantastic Four or something, but no, it's like New Gods is where I was like, oh, I get this now.
Okay, yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. So, and it makes a lot of sense too, because Byrne loves Kirby characters.
He does.
And so having him be the big bad, it's one of those things where when you read enough of these with Byrne, especially, it's just like, okay, if it's Byrne and he's guest starring the New Gods, he's going to tell you about the history of the New Gods. At some point in that story, he's going to tell you about the history of the New Gods. But it's really interesting, the versions that he draws, because Desaad is very like Kirby-esque.
Uh-huh.
He's not superpowers, but Kalibak, when we finally see him a little later, that is straight up the superpowers Kalibak.
So, yeah, it's right off the card. It's right off the, there's no shying away from it. I do love that Byrne loves the New Gods. What I think is really funny is, in retrospect, I had the honor, a huge question mark, of covering Genesis on DCOCD with I was, Peter Rios was guesting, and it was a fun episode. I mean, you know, I love the guys, I love that show, and actually I wish they would continue. I know they've ceased it, but they have a new show coming out, which I'm really excited for, and the Waiting for Doom guys. And so I was on that show and I covered Genesis with them. And it effectively, the plot of Genesis is spelled out in this issue, which is the old gods died, which is Thor. That's, you know, they had Ragnarok. When they die, New Genesis and Apocalypse emerge as sort of the new gods. That's why they're the new gods. It's the fourth world. And then this Genesis wave, this wave of godly energy, pours through the universe and hits the earth. And that's where the Greek gods come from, which, you know, I have to say, I think is a better explanation of the Greek gods than what we got in that Legion annual, where they were all Durlins who had crashed on Earth and, you know, didn't so much have magic powers as just could shapeshift. But it's a Genesis wave. I mean, he literally would just do a 4-issue miniseries about this 10 years later. It's crazy.
Yeah. So I also covered that on Batgirl to Oracle, because Shag told Stella that it's my favorite crossover and that I would love to cover it.
That might be the meanest thing somebody's ever done to another person.
It's the second time he's done that to me, involving that. Yeah. It's one of those things where, and this gets kind of into the story a little bit as well. This one is, not everything has to connect.
Yeah.
And so the idea that the same energy wave that created Darkseid and all them also created the Greek gods is a Roy Thomasian level of connection that, as a kid, I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool. But as an adult, I'm like, I don't need that in my life.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love it. I love that. You're right. It's the Eddie. Yeah. It's the Roy Thomas, you know, Tim Drake, you know, must be related to Arnold Drake or must be related, you know, I mean, like every, you know, oh, everybody. Oh, it's, yeah.
Dick Grayson is related to Robot Man's friend, yeah. Chuck Grayson, because they both are named Grayson.
Yeah. Yeah. Eddie from Eddie and the Cruisers is related to Darkseid because of his song, The Darkseid. You know, like it's Roy has never met a connection. He couldn't draw. God love the man. But
and Burn, too. Burn had Norman Osborn and Flint Marko, Sandman, related because they have the same hair.
I have to tell you, I had, you know, I think for a lot of us, we see Norman's hair and we're like, Is that a hair that we styled that exists? And then I had a student one year who had that exact hair and actually was a little bit of a Norman Osborn. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. I get it. I see it now.
One of the officials that like ran the insurance industry in Georgia back in the early 2000s had that hair too. And I hated that man. So
yeah. Universally, not a great sign when somebody has Norman Osborn hair. So it's Darkseid and Desaad. They are trying to capture Olympus. They're trying to capture the god wave power that Olympus absorbed when the previous gods, when Ragnarok occurred. It's kind of a half-baked plan. There's not a lot of thought into it. But what they do to Superman and Wonder Woman is they send two people to them. We don't know who it is at first. We have a woman go to Superman, a man go to Wonder Woman. And each appears to be the other. The Superman that comes to Wonder Woman attacks her physically. The Wonder Woman that goes to Superman attacks him sexually, dives into another kiss, but this time she's initiating. And then Darkseid's, haha, I'm going to reveal who this really is. The Superman is actually Kalibak. More interestingly, the Wonder Woman is Amazing Grace.
Yep.
Superman and Amazing Grace have a little bit of history.
Oh, yes, they do.
Yeah, when it comes to John Byrne. Now, do you want to capture that for the listeners, or do you want me to do a quick synopsis?
It's essentially this. During the Legends crossovers where Amazing Grace was introduced, and she's brought into the Adventures of Superman issue, where Superman is on Apocalypse, he has amnesia, and she is apparently one of the lowlies that is helping him and bringing him to like be one of the heroes of the underclass, and it all turns out crap in the end. And there is a scene where he's getting a bath and she comes in and she's taking her clothes off. And the secret to John and Superman is that he will have sex. He just has to be under control somehow or something else to do so. So they have definitely knocked boots.
Yes. Yeah. This is for anybody listening who isn't familiar with this, this is around the same time when Sleaze takes mental control over Superman and Barda and makes them film an adult video that he later shows to Mr. Miracle. I mean, just, oh, John, you know, again, 90-10, man. The 90s great. The 10 is so weird. It's so very weird.
And the 10 is always like, it's not just like, well, that's kind of weird. It's always like, dude.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, yeah, it's the, you know, James McDonald Hudson is 35 and Heather McDonald Hudson is 17. And it's like, no one needed that, dude. Heather could have been 25.
No one needed to see the new Superman in the future Superman of Generations 3 kiss a 12-year-old Lana Lang.
Yeah. Yeah, I just, oh, God. Oh, John. So this actually brings me to my next secret question, because I was super excited to see Amazing Grace. So in the issue, Superman runs into Amazing Grace, who, one night, quite an ex-girlfriend, is someone with whom he has a history. In any medium, so it can be comics, movies, anything, who is your favorite ex-girlfriend or boyfriend for the protagonist? What's a character you love that's whose role is the ex?
This is another really kind of one that just bugged me. But one of my favorites is one, and it's a cheat because she ends up with him at the end of the second season. And that's Mackenzie from Newsroom.
Oh.
I love that show on a level that is probably not healthy, but they had great ex dynamic through the entire first and through most of the second season. And they end up together at the end of the second season, but they were exes very much. And she was dating somebody else and he was other people. So that's where I'm sliding it in. But that is one of my favorites because it's just, She's an awesome character to begin with, but she knew she screwed up, but she still would call him on his bullshit.
Yeah.
At every possible moment.
No, and I love a fiery dynamic like that. And I especially love when a fiery dynamic like that changes the storytelling. Like, this is going to be such a dumb example, but it's the one I think about all the time when I think about this. Like, Dawson's Creek, if you remember that show, mm-hmm. was about the relationship between Dawson and Joey. And it's about all their friends too. But it is, you know, Dawson and Joey as one true pairing. It's always going to be Dawson and Joey. They're going to have their hiccups, but it's always going to end up being Dawson and Joey. And yet, she has such great chemistry with Pacey, with Joshua Jackson, mm-hmm. that they rewrite much of the series where she ends up with Pacey because they're so good together. And she and Dawson are so sort of stilted together that anybody with eyes goes, yeah, it should really be Pacey and Joey, not Dawson and Joey. And so anyway, I don't know. I always thought they should be together. So my favorite X, I'm going to stay in comics, and this is a dumb one, but when I started collecting Batman, it was 1983. Doug Mensch was writing. It was Gene Colan and Alfredo Alcala on art, which, holy crap, right? Like, Tomb of Dracula, Swamp Thing, Gotham has never looked darker or murkier. And the main love interest for Bruce Wayne, and he had three. He had four. He had Vicki Vale. He had Julia Pennyworth. He had Catwoman. And then he had Natalia Knight, a.k.a. Nocturna. Now, if you don't remember her, don't feel bad. But for those of us who collected in that era, she was it. She was like a major romantic interest for Batman, even though she was so unhealthy. She was in love with her stepbrother, who was the mm-hmm. night slasher or night slayer, who would go around killing women with knives in order to kind of try to kill her vicariously. Very weird. To get back at Bruce, she tries to adopt Jason Todd from underneath him. He should have let that happen. But she tries to steal Jason Todd from him. And then she meets her doom, seemingly, in a hot air balloon, fighting her brother slash lover in the middle of crisis, in the middle of the red skies. And I don't know. All I remember is their prose was so purple that mm-hmm. even Anne Rice was like, tone it down, guys. Like, this is crazy. But I just love him. I love Nocturna to this day. And if you ask me Bruce's, like, five great romances, I'm putting her on the list. So do you remember her at all?
I have read those issues. I did not read them at the time, but I have read those issues. And Mensch, that was not a book that kids should have been reading.
No, it was dark.
Because Andy and I will be covering an issue, a storyline from that era. Not the Nocturna era, it's the Poison Ivy.
Oh yeah, great story.
For Overlooked in February. And like his whole approach to Bruce and romance was just way more than anybody was really prepared for. And Nocturna mm-hmm. is like one of those, like, if you had a goth awakening as a kid, it was probably with her. And dynamic with her brother. It's just like, yeah. Why does this... Well, in this Batman story, I mean, can we get back to Talia and Catwoman fighting in the Batmobile over Bruce? Can we get back to that?
Yeah, it is. And you're funny. Right. No kid should have been reading it. And yet it was my intro to Batman. But it's almost like Mensch read like H.P. Lovecraft and V.C. Andrews and was like, why not both? Like, why not? Like, why limit myself to one when I can have flowers, you know, in Cthulhu's attic? Like, you know, it was so I've gone back and reread it. And I love it still because of just it, like it to use the word again, it imprinted on me. But it is so violent and dark, and the sexuality in it is so messed up that even Chris Claremont's like, hey man,
like you need to chill out.
Yeah, your proclivities are showing, man. What are you doing? So in back to Action 600, we get a string of amazing pages where they do something right out of a Marx Brothers movie. Where Amazing Grace is fleeing and Superman's chasing her, Kalibak is fleeing, Wonder Woman's chasing him. They both turn a corner, disappear, and then Wonder Woman and Superman are facing each other for real, and they don't know it's the other, so they start fighting, and it's these four-panel quadrant pages, Darkseid's head in the middle laughing, the two of them just going at it, but they smash through into where Darkseid and Desaad are at, and you realize it was a trick all along. They realized that who they were actually fighting. They kind of silently agreed to do a mock battle. They get to Darkseid and Desaad, and now, you know, they're confronting them. What did you think of even the art or the writing of the mock battle scene?
Oh, I thought it was fantastic. I mean, it's absolutely amazing, and it plays into the strengths of both characters. I mean, both artists. But it's one of those things, like, the rubble is all Paris. especially like Darkseid's face changing. Like at first he's just like, yes. And then he's laughing because he's like, oh, this is working out even perfect. Look, Superman's on fire. Like how did that happen? He's like, wait, something doesn't feel right about this. And then they burst into the room.
Yeah. Look, it's payoff for fan service. I mean, this is fan service 101. We get Superman and Wonder Woman kissing, which is a payoff of, you know, 40 years of fanfic, 50 years of fanfic. And we get who would win in a fight, Superman or Wonder Woman. And we get them going at each other seemingly full force. And it's pretty evenly matched, which is fun. And then it's like, no, actually, we're way smarter than this. We knew what you were up to. And then we get the resolution, which is they confront Darkseid and Desaad. And instead of fighting them, Wonder Woman basically says, like, what are you doing here? And he's like, well, I came to capture Olympus. I'm going to capture the godly energy here. And she's like, look around you. The gods are gone. And he's like, what? And she's like, yeah, they're not here. He's like, no, they're hiding. My parademons will find them. And then Captain Parademon shows up. He's like, no, actually, sir, they're gone. And then he dies for that, delivering the bad news. And then Desaad and Darkseid kind of look at each other. They shrug. They fly away. Darkseid tries to blow Olympus up on his way out, even admitting he's being petty. But Olympus isn't that easily destroyed. And that's kind of the end of that part of the adventure. It's pretty anticlimactic. What did you think about it?
Oh, I hate the whole, I'm sorry, Darkseid, the Olympian gods you're looking for are in another castle.
Exactly, yeah.
It's just, and then he tries to blow it up and Superman's like, oh no, and then nothing happens. It's like they did endings, as Professor Allen is wont to say, are hard. And yes. I get that this story isn't so much a story, it's an idea. It's an excuse to, Action Comics at this time was the excuse of this Superman mixing it up with the characters of the DC universe.
Yes.
And Byrne getting to play with them. So sometimes it's really good. And sometimes it's, you know, the Metal Men keep coming back, which is unfair because those are two eminently readable issues.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's Jonathan Kent revealing that he and Martha raised Superman and Clark Kent together and try to pass that off to Lois. And it's just like, I didn't think you could make the whole Smallville Millennium thing even worse, John. Good on you.
Yeah.
So it's like at the end, it's just like nothing. It's just like, okay, they had a fight. This was exciting, but we have no way to resolve this. So Darkseid's going to disappear. You know, I'll get you Gadget, you know, and leaves. And then it doesn't blow up. And then they decide to part as friends.
Yeah, it's so poorly done, considering the creative power behind it. And I agree with you, this is the book for, appropriately, for action. But it is there are so many weird choices along this run. Like wrapping up the Thanagar War for Hawkman, the Shadow War in action, really bad choice. Like that's Hawkman's defining story to that point. And I think his best story to that point. And you're like, if you're interested, go follow the ending in Action Comics. And it's like, oh, that kind of sucks. And then you get some, like you said, some really fun issues. I like the Green Lantern, Phantom Stranger, you know, the Green Lantern Corps ones. I think those are really cool. The Checkmate one is fun. I like that it sets up, you know, Paul Cooperberg's Checkmate series. But this was so, not only was it anticlimactic as a story, you can almost hear like bum, 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 in the background when Diana's like, when the Parademon's like, no, actually, sir, there's no one here. I would rather have had it been left as a mystery for Wonder Woman to follow up in her own book. Like, where are the gods? Or set up something more other than, well, no one's here. Well, I guess that means I can't steal their power. I'll blow it up on the way out. But actually, no, you can't really blow it up because it's Olympus. It's an idea. And it's like, oh, okay, I guess. Even Darkseid can't, though? Because, like, you know, he's not using, like, grenades. He's Darkseid. You know? So, yeah, not a very good ending to the story, to the action proper. But we do get a little bit of a coda. So Superman and Wonder Woman return to Earth and they're, you know, they have the opportunity if they want to pick up on that first date again. And this is where we get my favorite moment in the book, which is Clark saying to Diana, hey, you know, I misread that first moment, you know, when we kiss. And now that I'm getting to know you, I'm realizing we really don't belong together. You are basically a goddess and I am a simple farm boy from Kansas. And I don't know that we're in this. He's like, you're super out of my league. And she's very kind about it. And she's like, no, I don't think that's true. She's like, but how about we part as friends? And she's like, I'm Diana. And he's like, I'm Clark. So, you know, that's a big moment, right? Sharing his name with her. And so what did you think of that parting of the ways?
I don't like him saying you're out of my league, because it's just like, so you're saying you're settling for Lois?
Yeah, I guess so.
That feels weird, but again, 90-10.
Yeah.
I like that they part as friends. I am very much against Superman and Wonder Woman being together as
Me
a couple.
Me too.
Mainly because, one, it's so obvious.
Yeah.
Like, oh, they're just, you know, like, he's like the biggest and she's the biggest. So obviously they should be together. And it's just like, no, I am Lois and Clark to the end.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of that is also that during the New 52, they were together as a couple. And I will say it made sense for those versions of those characters.
I could see that.
Because that the New 52 was very much the Image Comics version of DC Comics.
It really was.
And what I mean by that is that Superman did not have a supporting cast.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you saw Lois and you saw Jimmy from time to time. They would sometimes be part of the story. But mostly he was hanging out with other superheroes. So in that case, they kind of make a weird sense. Because they're all, you know, like, she's not with Steve Trevor anymore and they decide to hook up, whatever. But I went with it like I went with everything else in the New 52 because I didn't have a choice.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I could either do this or leave. And I don't feel like leaving right now. But I just don't like them as a couple because I think Lois is such a better pairing for him.
Oh, yeah. And unassailably.
And it gives him a connection to humanity,
mm-hmm.
that the person that he falls in love with, that he decides is the one for him, is just this extraordinary woman. And I know that Steve Trevor and Diana had a whole thing for in like the, especially in the Silver Age, where he was constantly trying to get her to marry him. And she was like, no, until the very last issue. And mm-hmm. yeah, of course,
yeah,
that's unfair. But this Wonder Woman particularly, I'm not saying she's asexual. I just don't see her as having romantic feelings for anybody yet.
Yeah.
Like, she is so new to the world that I don't see, like, if she's going to date anybody, it's definitely not going to be Superman.
Well, and I think you're hitting on something. This version of Wonder Woman, Perez has drawn a line and said, we're not going to define her by a love interest. We're not playing that game. She is her own character. She will stand alone. Where we are as a society right now, if we pair her up, she's automatically going to become defined by that pairing. So we're not pairing her up. We're taking Steve Trevor off the board immediately by making him significantly older than her and being more of a mentor. And then, and I didn't think about this until prepping for this episode, because I thought about them pairing her up in them up in New 52. And I hate, and so you're funny because you're like, well, I could either read it or I could leave. I left. That was the moment where I went, oh, I'm done. I gave you a chance, New 52, and I'm out. And at one point I was only collecting, I think, Batman, and maybe like I, Vampire, which I thought was a really good book. But anyway, I left at that point. I was like, nope, I don't believe in these two. I think this is really bad. And it was funny because I think that, you know, in post-crisis, the possibility to pair them up was very much there. Byrne and Perez could have said, hey, the rule book's out the window. We could actually do this. And so I like that they teased the reader and said, hey, you know, it's post-crisis. It's a new universe. Everything you thought you knew was wrong. We could make this happen. And then they're like, no, even we know this is a bad idea. They're really good friends. We'll keep it that way. And I also just love their friendship. I love that like she can call him on his bull. I love that she can, you know, she's the really good. And I have a friend like this. One of my best friends since high school. We've been friends and we've never been romantically involved. And she is a person, and I'm the same way for her, but she is a person who over the years, you know, I'd be dating somebody and she would just look at me and go, what are you doing? And I'd be like, no. And then she'd just look at me and start laughing and go, okay, you keep telling yourself that. And in 2 weeks, call me and tell me I was right. And I, you know, 2 weeks, I'd be like, damn you. You know, and so yeah, I love Clark and Diana's relationship. And I'm glad they didn't take this any further. But it does bring me to my last secret question of the episode. So in this issue, this is the post-crisis first big interaction between Superman and Wonder Woman, who pre-crisis obviously had thousands of interactions together. What is your favorite retcon of two characters' first adventure or first time meeting, you know, post some sort of retcon? Do you have a favorite or a least favorite?
a favorite first meeting post retcon? Ooh,
I can go first if that's helpful. I can give you a little time.
Yeah, you go first. I mean, because I've been thinking about this all day, and I still haven't come up with a definitive one. I've got a couple ideas, but you go with yours, and I'll narrow it down.
One of my favorite books that came out of post-crisis DC, and it's kind of an under-the-radar gem, is Captain Atom. It was written by Kerry Bates and Greg Wiseman, you know, who would go on to create mm-hmm. Gargoyles, and it was drawn by Pat Broderick. And it is such a cool, kind of a spy thriller slash superhero book. I wouldn't say it's proto-Vertigo, but it's close. And the cool thing about it is, in post-crisis DC universe, Captain Atom is Nathaniel Adams is a captain in the army in the 60s. He gets falsely convicted of a crime. And in order to expunge his record and kind of basically give his benefits to his family, he volunteers to go into this project. He doesn't know what it is. Well, the U.S. government has found this like alien metal, this like ship, and they put him in it. And they detonate a nuke under it. Like, let's see what happens if we nuke this ship. They don't know this, but he's shunted into the future 20 years, and he appears. He's back as Nathaniel Atom, but he can also turn into this superhero, Captain Atom. Well, the military wants its own superhero, so they create a backstory for him to make him more palatable for the public. And they create all these fake nemeses and adventures. Like, he fought Dr. Spectro, and he and Nightshade used to team up. Well, Nightshade's a spy for the government, so she agrees to this. The beauty of this in the storytelling mode is the fictional history they make up for him are all his adventures from the Charlton comics, where he was a main character until DC bought Charlton and brought those characters over. The second brilliant decision they make is part of his backstory involves him teaming up a bunch with Blue Beetle, another Charlton character. Except this time, Blue Beetle's firmly affixed in the DC universe, and Beetle looks around and goes, I don't know that dude. We never teamed up. What the hell is this? And so he and a few JLI members go and confront Captain Atom, and it's the moment where the false narrative crosses the Rubicon, and it's a big story in changing that series where he's got to come forward and admit the lie. And it's just such brilliant storytelling, a way of layering in the real world elements of purchasing another company's character into the narrative of your new universe. So I loved the first meeting of Captain Atom and Nightshade and Captain Atom and Blue Beetle, because it was all a lie, but it was a lie based in truth, which is really cool. Like, I think that was really cool. So, all right. So have you thought of one?
Mine's a deep cut.
Okay.
And it's a post-crisis thing. And I am one of five people that will tell you how much I love this series. I love retconning that Savannah was Billy's uncle by through weird familial things and tried to adopt him just to get his money.
Oh, wow.
I really liked Shazam: A New Beginning,
yeah,
the four-issue miniseries. Again, you read something when you're 13 years old, and it's the greatest thing ever. And I realize that there are Captain Marvel fans out there that are just like, no, it was dark. John Andrews was the wrong person for that, blah, blah. But as a way of trying to revamp the character, I think it had a lot going.
Look, I don't disagree. I was a fan of that mini. It is too dark in my mind for Captain Marvel. It's Tom Mandrake's on art. I mean, it's very murky. It is a very dark book. And I like it as it's a standalone story. I agree. I like the Power of Shazam, Jerry Ordway stuff better. But if you ask me, do I like that Billy Batson from the four-issue Roy Thomas mini more than the Geoff Johns, oh, I'm a cursing little criminal? Yeah, give me Roy any day.
It is one of those things, isn't it? It's so... That character got batted around pretty hardcore through those 30 years anyways. I mean, let's not forget the post Infinite Crisis era.
Oh,
where,
God.
Where Freddy was Shazam.
Yeah.
For 5 minutes. But no, I like that idea, because that's somebody coming up. Like, I will appreciate noble failures more than mediocre successes.
Yeah. Yeah. And take a big swing.
And Thomas, who loved that world, came in and said, I'm going to do this new version of it. Mm-hmm. And it didn't take, and it happens. But what it leaves behind is this really interesting artifact.
Yeah, it is actually. It's a miniseries no one talks about, though it has great art. I mean, Tom Mandrake is amazing. But yeah, that's so funny. You really probably are one of only five people who love that minute.
Yeah, no, I really, and it's like one of those things where, again, I mentioned my co-host Andy. We talk a lot about how sometimes we're on the island waving as everybody's going by.
Yes,
and you're just there by yourself. So.
Yes, yeah, that is absolutely true. Each of us has that one. Actually, let me put it to you this way. I'm a member of the Fire and Water Network, and I love Tom King. So, I mean, there is no lonelier island at my network than being a fan of Tom King. And just, you should, the group chat is just vitriolically against the man. And every once in a while, I'll peep up and go, yeah, but did any of you read Omega Men? Did any of you read Sheriff of Babylon? But actually, his Wonder Woman run's really, really good. Actually, I've got Ryan to read it, and he likes it. So I feel like, you know, that's good.
I have a secret question for you at the end as well.
Okay.
So given everything about this story, do you think it would have been better if Darkseid showed up because he was in love with Wonder Woman and wanted to marry her a la the Superpowers television series?
A la Superpowers. I'm so sick of the, like, every bad guy wants to marry Storm, every bad guy wants to marry Wonder Woman plot.
Yeah.
So that I would almost never answer yes to this. But given that the alternative is, oh, oops, we showed up and no one was home, so now we'll go back to Apocalypse. Yeah, actually, it would have been better. It really would have been, because at least it would have had a plot, and at least it would have been a funny tip of the cap to that cartoon series.
I'm saying that him coming to Earth to make him his bride while Superman is also trying to make a pitch.
Oh, that's funny.
It's like it would have made a more, like, at least character driven story, but that wasn't the point of this.
Yeah.
The point of this was to get the two together and to have John Byrne and George Perez work together. And it's funny, you can tell when Perez is truly doing the finishes.
Uh-huh.
And it's all in how the cape looks on his shoulders.
Yeah. It's the just, eyes so, too. He gives Diana has Perez eyes all the way through this.
Yes. And it's amazing because they're two different styles, really. Mm-hmm. Both coming from similar backgrounds.
Yeah.
But Byrne was more Kirby bombastic, and Perez was more Neil Adams realistic.
Yeah.
In terms of how they draw their characters, and yet those two come together, and it's a beautiful story. And that's really the point of it. And at the end of the day, sometimes that's all you really need. Like, we're talking about it in a podcast, and so we have to pick it apart because that's what you do on a podcast. We have to, because neither one of us were stars of a 90s sitcom that can parlay that into podcasting success. But at the end of the day, if somebody was just reading this, they'd probably just love it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, that's really exciting. I'm going to go to the next story. Oh, it's Win Mortimer artwork. That's okay.
Yeah, that part is abrupt. Yes. No, you're 100% right. Sometimes it's okay if your outline for an issue is just, what if Wonder Woman and Superman kissed? What if they fought? and that's it. Like, and that's totally awesome. And actually, it also sets up one of my all-time favorite comic books, which is an issue of Astro City by Kurt Busiek and Brent Anderson, where Samaritan and their Superman analogy, their pastiche, and I'm blanking on Lady Liberty, I think, is their Wonder Woman of that universe. They actually go out on a date, and they're like, hey, everybody wants this to happen. Let's just see what happens. And it's awkward in moments. It's fun in moments. It's interesting in moments. And I think that issue doesn't happen without Action 600. I think Busiek very fondly remembers this comic.
Yeah, it's again, it's one of those pairings that some people might think, oh, that's obvious. And yeah, I'm not going to take that away from anybody. It's weird being in a position of having so many opinions about something that are very firm. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, we are talking about fictional characters.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, somebody, you know, there are people out there that love the idea of Wonder Woman and Superman together.
Yeah.
And there are people out there that, and I found this out by the comment section when I was reviewing Superman Wonder Woman, that think that not only should Superman not be with Wonder Woman, but Lois Lane should have nothing to do with him as well.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it's and so it's, you know, all the permutations of these types of things. But like I said before, I think when you look at this story in particular, like, Paris as Wonder Woman is not something like you hit the nail on the head. He went out of his way that she isn't going to be romantically tied to anybody.
Yeah.
So now it's hard for me to ever think of her romantically tied to anybody.
And I do like, so it's funny because I grew up on this run. I was not a pre-crisis Wonder Woman collector at all. And so Steve Trevor for me has only ever been her older mentor. I knew conceptually he was her love interest pre-crisis, but I didn't have any experience in there. And so post New 52, and then more importantly, sort of post rebirth, when Greg Rucka and Gail Simone and Tom King and just some of the better writers to tackle her book brought Steve Trevor back as a legitimate love interest. I dig them together. I like them together now. I'm like, oh, they're pretty cool. But I also like the fact that DC's not married to that coupling anymore. It's like, yeah, Steve's great, but there could be others. And I like that. And also, as somebody who loves Kingdom Come by Mark Waid and Alex Ross, Superman and Wonder Woman, not a great couple when they are together. They're horrible in that book. She is horrible in that book. And she mistreats him. I mean, I don't know. I read that book and I went, yeah, they don't belong together. And if you want proof, here's why. But I digress. So before we jump to the next segment, Michael, I'd like to ask, do you have a favorite panel from the book? Is there a favorite piece of art that jumped out to you?
It's odd that you say that because, you know, you would think, oh, maybe it's the one of the panels from the fight scene, or maybe it's the fight scene itself. My favorite is Superman realizing that his powers don't work. I love that entire page because he tries to use his X-ray and telescopic vision. He sees the back of his head. He takes off to fly and immediately falls to the ground. And his response is, oh, great. Obviously, none of my powers are going to work in any kind of straightforward fashion in this topsy-turvy place. And he's saying that while standing on the side.
Yeah.
It's just so great.
It is real. That is a really good choice. I honorable mention to the fight, the four quadrant fight scenes. Those are brilliantly rendered. My favorite actually is going to come on page 14 at the top when Amazing Grace is pretending to be Wonder Woman, Kalibik is pretending to be Superman, and they encounter the real Wonder Woman and Superman for the first time. And Amazing Grace throws her arms around our Superman to kiss him. And he has this very surprised, innocent farm boy look on his face, which is really cute. And then we cut to Kalibik as Superman showing his true colors to Diana. And he has what I always call evil Superman face. And Perez does evil Superman face better than anybody. I love it. I mean, it's John Cena looking at The Rock and betraying Cody Rhodes. Like, it is the best heel turn face ever. And Perez is the master of the evil Superman face. So I love that moment.
It's also an interesting bit romantic. Like, if you removed all of the dialogue, it looks like she's kissed Superman and he's responded by punching her away.
Actually, you're right. He's like, hey, get away from me, lady.
Consent.
Well, hey. I mean, if he knew it was Amazing Grace, fully appropriate. Yeah. Yeah. That woman definitely needs a visit to HR. She definitely needs some, you know. Some CBTs.
You know, it's funny because Amazing Grace, like, she had a very sultry appearance, especially in the Action Comics issue when she's in her Who's Who outfit, as I'll call it. And here they give her a full-on Kirby outfit and look.
Yeah.
Like, she got a blowout and, you know, she got the armor. And it's just so weird. Honorable mention, by the way, to page 15, because Darkseid is obviously all about branding. There is a panel where a bunch of parademons are re-sculpting Zeus's face into Darkseid's.
It is awesome. I mean, it's Batman-esque. It is awesome. It's like, step one, my face everywhere. I mean, it's, you know, it's a Legion 300 or whatever, you know, Daxum, you know, being refaced into Darkseid's head, which still to me, I don't know how the poles work on that planet now. I don't really get it, but it's a fun issue, and it's, you know, just the art's amazing. I love the pairing of Perez and Byrne. I didn't know it would work quite that well together. It reminds me of, if you've ever read Avengers Annual 13 from like 1984, it's where they go to Project Pegasus and Arnim Zola is using this goo to create a bunch of Hulk facsimiles and the Avengers have to fight the goo. But it's Steve Ditko pencil, John Byrne finishes.
Yeah, so you get that.
Oh my gosh, you get the wild Ditko body poses and hands and eyes sometimes, but the precision of Byrne to tighten it up, and it weirdly works brilliantly.
Yeah, there are some times where somebody inked somebody else, and it's like Perez inking Kurt Swan in Superman 423, where, like, it's not that Kurt Swan is a slouch or anything, but there was a polish to that story, that issue, where I'm like, you know, maybe if they had done this more, we wouldn't have had Man of Steel.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a really good point. Yeah. Yeah. And then there are also then times when it fails miserably. I think about the mid to late 90s where Bill Sienkiewicz would sometimes ink Jim Aparo on Batman. And it was interesting. It was definitely a thing they tried. But I, you know, two great tastes that didn't necessarily go great together for me.
I'm there when Klaus Janson has inked Dan Jurgens.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think it works as well.
Yeah. Oh God. That, yeah, exactly. Again, just, yeah. Ooh, that doesn't necessarily work. So Michael, at the end of every episode and listeners at the end of every episode, we close the segment with the guest in a segment I like to call Bringing Peace to Man's World, where, like Diana, the guest and I try to put forward an idea that would bring a little peace to the world. Now, since you're the guest, I'll have you get the last word and I will go first. So in a silly way to bring peace to man's world, I would actually give every person on the planet the resources and the ability to create an animated Pixar movie version of their own life. And I would have them narrate it. I would have them have it, you know, directed by professionals, but it's their own story. They can make talking cars, talking animals. They can make it whatever they want. And they can update it every 10 years. But everybody gets their own movie version of their own life. And I thought about how nice this would be as a shorthand to get to know new people. You know, it's like, oh, hey, I'm starting a new job. I'm sending you my Pixar movie, you know, ahead of me coming on my first day. Now you all know that I grew up on a small farm in Kansas and I'm allergic to paprika. You know, oh, hey, I'm meeting my girlfriend's parents at Christmas for the first time. I'll send my cartoon life story ahead. And now they'll know, you know, that I was, you know, my parents were died in an alley and I swore vengeance on all criminals. Like I just think it would be a fun shorthand way to get to know each other. And, you know, since you're in control of your own movie, you can decide what to include and not to include. But I think it would force everybody to be reflective. I think it would force everybody to be a little bit whimsical since it's a cartoon. And it would allow people to get to know each other in a more sort of judgment-free zone. So that's my silly idea. What about yours?
I went a little more serious just because I have been struggling for especially the past year. But mm-hmm. it's been a rough decade.
It has.
I would have to say. And what I will say, and this is going to be one of those like, wow, that's a left turn after what Sean just talked about. I would take money out of politics.
Oh, good.
I would make it so that single people and corporations cannot give millions and billions of dollars to a candidate so that the playing field is more even in terms of getting the best person for the job, which would hopefully make the idea of being a senator, a congressman, a president, whatever, a cause rather than a means to get more power or money. The runner up to that, I was just like, well, maybe I'll talk about like making it so that people in Congress can't invest in the stock market. But it's just like, getting the money out of politics in terms of especially campaigns, I think does that job a little better.
Yes, and yes to everything you just said. I think about silly, but I think about the Legion in the Baxter run by Paul Levitz, and I think it's Greg LaRocque at this point. They have a presidential election, and actually the candidates are selected by like this computer, and they're selected based on things like papers you wrote for school and like volunteer work you've done and community thing. Like it's not about politics or money or power. It is really a like an objective examination of who will do the most good for the most people and is most equipped to do it. And I always thought about like, oh, what a cool idea. And yeah, if you could remove the money and you know, lobbying and all of that stuff, that's here. I like yours much better than mine. Much better than my little Pixar movie one.
I feel bad too, because it's just like, you know, I like that idea. It's one of those things where what you're essentially getting to the heart of is that you're trying to have, if people get to know each other better, we'll get along better.
Yes. Yeah.
So that is an entirely noble idea that my cold, cynical heart right now.
Well, no, and one of the other just facts of doing this show is I have to come up with one of these every episode. And so I like to mix it up and do like a fun one, a heavy one, a silly one. And so, you know, it's always funny because I don't look at the guests ahead of time. And so it's funny, like with our Lasso of Truth moments, you know, they had something very much in common. And then I like when there's a nice contrast as well. Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining me. You know, not only could I not talk about Superman without reaching out to you first, but I just, you know, again, this is the first time we've had a chance to record just one-on-one, and it is as much fun as I had hoped it would be, and I'm just really thankful for your expertise and your joy and the, you know, the love that you bring to all of this. And then on a personal note, I told you this before, I have literally spent thousands maybe of hours, you know, in listening to your shows over the past, you know, 15 plus year, 20 almost years, 17. And I'm just so thankful for all of the work that you do, because it is such an amazing way to, as somebody who grew up with zero friends who collected comic books and didn't connect to anybody who understood the hobby until I was an adult, it is so much fun to get to hear content produced by people who love the things that I love or don't love the things that I love and why. And it's just, you know, so I think I'm speaking for a lot of listeners when I say thank you, thank you, thank you for all of your amazing years of shows.
Well, I really appreciate that. I appreciate you having me on to be the person to talk about this issue. It's not an issue of Wonder Woman. that alone makes it kind of different, but also I have grown to appreciate how, I don't want to say sensitive, but you bring a level of compassion and kind of humanity in the way you talk about comics.
Thank you.
That I just really appreciate. Because sometimes I'm just like, this page is really cool because that guy looks cool punching that other guy. And it's so amusing that so many podcasters who talk about comics are also in the education field.
Yes. Yeah. There are a lot of us. Yes.
So there's that too. It's just like one of those things where this guy's really smart. Why does he want me on his show? No, I appreciate it. This was a lot of fun. It was fun revisiting this because I have been reappraising Byrne in the past like year or so, which is going to culminate later in 2026 in my 40th anniversary Man of Steel episode of It Nice. All Comes Back to Superman, where I break the internet in half with my opinions, which isn't true at all, but still.
Well, since you mentioned it, and I know most people listening already know, why don't you tell people where they can find your shows?
Two shows that I do regularly, because that's all I have time for. It All Comes Back to Superman, which I was going to originally bring a kind of a halt to, but I've decided not to do that. That's going to be twice a month. Hopefully, maybe a little extra as time allows. This is going to be a really weird year for me. But also, twice a month, my friend Andy Leyland and I get together, and we talk about Batman stories that we think not a whole lot of other people are talking about. Mm-hmm. So one episode could be all about Ed Brubaker's run, and then we talk about two Doug Mensch stories, one from 1983 and one from 1995. So just as a compare and contrast of how that changed. And the answer to that is not a whole lot. And okay. So at the very end of this month, the grand reopening, I had a site for 17 years called mm-hmm. Fortress of Baletude that went away because they wanted $1,500 for me to continue.
That's insane.
And I'm like, no,
yeah,
I don't do this for a living, which unfortunately has made certain shows unavailable currently. But I will be launching, doing the grand opening of the new site, which is Bailey Planet.
Nice.
Isamu came through and did a wonderful Bailey Planet globe for me. And I was just like, okay, this is the kick in the ass that I needed to get this going. And it's just basically going to be rebuilding parts of the fortress and doing other different things. So that's baileyplanet.org.
That's awesome. That's super exciting. I'm so glad. I cannot wait for that to launch. And yeah, the shows are amazing. The decades worth of shows. I was just listening to your Greg Rucka episode with you and Andy. I'm a huge Greg Rucka fan on Batman. Mm-hmm. And it was so much fun to hear you guys go back and forth. And so thank you again for joining me. This has been a blast. And listeners, we will take a podcast promo break and then come back with your feedback from my most recent episode.
So, Andy, we have to do a new trailer for The Overlooked Dark Knight.
Really? Why?
Because we moved.
We moved?
Yeah, things weren't working out with the system that I've used since 2008, and the episodes are taking forever to come out, so I just moved us over to Libsyn.
And is this going to change anything about the show?
Oh, absolutely not. We're still reading Batman comics and talking about them.
Well, because it's hard to talk about comics you've not read.
For the most part.
And we're sticking to the Batman comics that have been overlooked or forgotten over the years?
That's the plan.
And we're just going to abandon that format whenever we want from time to time?
More than likely. I mean, it is us.
Yeah, right.
Rules are meant to be broken anyway.
And what about the old episodes?
Well, the old episodes will still be available on the old feed. I have no plans on closing that out. I may start porting some of those over to the new feed, but all of the feeds are going to stand for the moment. For the new episodes, just look for the album cover with the Jerry Bingham art wherever you look for your podcasts.
Seems relatively foolproof.
And I'll still be doing posts at www.fortressofbaileytwo.com, where people can leave comments, see the covers, and occasionally pages from the comics we talk about.
Brilliant. So, meeting adjourned. Pint?
I'm up for that.
We are back from that podcast promo break to cover your feedback from Wonder Woman Volume 2, Issue 16, which I covered with Dr. Christopher Maverick. As always, I encourage you to leave a review on Apple Podcasts and to leave feedback at fireandwaterpodcast.com, as it helps folks to find the show. So up first is going to be David Ace Gutierrez, who writes in, "The Sean AZ Chronicles are really taking off. I think we can milk 5 or 6 seasons out of your misadventures, Sean." To quote one of my favorite shows, David, 6 seasons in a movie. 6 seasons in a movie. Up next is Martin Gray, who writes the best comic reviews in the business at the blog Too Dangerous for a Girl. Martin comments on Mav and I talking about how we have both been teaching so long that September 11th is no longer a touchstone for our students. Martin says, "It was fascinating to hear how with every year the relationship to kids to 9/11 is changing. You teachers are so patient. I'm really not impressed by students being so unengaged by something that happened before they were born, especially if it's recent. The British version of the Chase quiz show regularly has Generation Z contestants who are totally unembarrassed by their lack of knowledge in basic history, telling host Bradley Walsh, 'Before my time, Brad.' It's like they're studying solipsism. They have no interest in a world they weren't in." That cracks me up, Martin. I can actually hear the Gen Z, you know, the disinterest dripping from that comment. I will, though, as somebody who's taught for a long time, defend the kids of this generation. And you know, just like every generation, there is definitely a solipsism in pocket for teens. And then as they get older, they get more interested in history. They get more interested in the larger narrative of the world, how it connects to their stories, their family stories, and the world they're walking into. So they come around eventually, Martin. They really do. Martin goes on to comment on my Lasso of Truth story, where I dropped a rack of old thermometers, causing an entire building to evacuate due to a mercury spill. Martin says, "Sean, when those thermometers dropped, how come you never became a mercury-powered superhero? Or are you holding out on us? What's the, this, they had to be classified as a chemical spill business anyway. I shall look that up." Yeah, so Martin, in any other world, it had the crazy Karen in my class not yelled mercury spill and gone screaming out the room, everybody would have just gone, "Oh, we'll just sweep that up. They were just little balls of mercury in glass." I would have paid for the thermometers and it would have been sort of a nothing issue, but they had to qualify it as a chemical spill, as if I had, you know, I don't know, put nuclear waste out or something. But I also wonder why I didn't get superpowers, though with my luck, I would have ended up as Mercury from The Metal Man, unable to go 3 sentences without saying, "I'm the only solid that's liquid at room temperature." So, you know, I do want superpowers. I wish I'd gotten them then. Up next is Rob in SoCal commenting on the potential relationship between Wonder Woman and Superman that's building in the background of this issue, saying, "I certainly am not a Wonder Woman Superman shipper. However, the idea that Diana could be attracted to Superman is that he is the closest thing to a god she is going to find on man's world. On several occasions, DC has come close to getting that right. They've always fallen short of the mark.
Diana has a, quote, schoolgirl crush on Superman. The crush is her idealized version of a man. She has grown up with the mythology of Greek gods, and let's face it, they are all flawed, to put it kindly as possible. She sees the illusion of Clark as a god without that baggage. Poor Diana, time to learn everyone has baggage. Yeah, I have to say, though, Rob, given the choice between falling in love with a Greek god or Superman, I'll take Superman any day of the week. He may be flawed, but he's a lot less flawed than Zeus or any of the others. Tim Price, host of the Outcasters Under Siege, writes in saying, I do have a question on a small beat in the issue. The charity organizer really lashes out at Diana about enjoying the adulation, but the event was deliberately named the Wonder Woman Fair, banking on her popularity to bring in money for the fundraising. So isn't that hypocritical? Whether that organizer liked the idea, she was fine with including Diana at all, regardless of how far the promoting got, because it would help with their financial goals. You can't ask a celebrity to be present and then be surprised that the crowds are just interested in the celebrity. I understand the story moment giving Diana an uncomfortable life lesson, but there's a little bit of a miss on the delivery. Yeah, Tim, I agree with you, actually. That attack on her character came out of nowhere. And I almost thought, oh, is this like a supervillain thing? Like, is somebody paying her to do this or manipulating her to do this? Because, you know, to play up the anxiety Diana was already feeling. But no, she was just mean. And again, hypocritical. She was mad that her own charitable event was so damn successful. Tim goes on to say, oh, so this Silver Swan storyline goes off into limbo. Figures I'd hope she'd have more return under Paris, and she does appear in JLA Avengers number 3, but that must have more been George simply wanting to draw her again, and she was with other sound-based villains as they appeared in this era, like Sonar and Silver Banshee. That's so funny, Tim. I have not reread JLA Avengers in a long time. I did not realize the Silver Swan makes an appearance, especially this iteration of her, but, you know, lumping her in with those other Sonic villains makes sense. Tim goes on to say, as for great female villains, which was one of our secret questions, outside of comics, I go with Kai Winn from Star Trek Deep Space Nine. She's complex, intelligent, and utterly convinced she's in the right while doing the most awful things. In comics, there's too many to choose from. The particular choice on my mind, thanks to starting to revisit Avengers Under Siege, is Moonstone. An expert manipulator, smart, powerful, and ruthless. It's a shame she was so underused before Thunderbolts, of course. And huge shout out to Tim. I love Moonstone. She's an amazing character in Under Siege. She's an amazing character in the Thunderbolts. She's an amazing character in all of her iterations. Just a, you know, basically she is a psychologist and she uses those skills to manipulate others. And I want to give a huge, huge plug to this show. Tim did Outcasters, which covered all of the Batman and the Outsiders, and then the subsequent Baxter Outsiders series, which was brilliant, and is now covering Roger Stern, John Buscema, and Tom Palmer's amazing Under Siege arc from the 80s, which is the best Avengers arc of all time. And I just am so excited for this show. Network All-Star Brett Young, host of The Fantastic Four, is up next, and he says, great show as always. I have to disagree and say I really liked the cover. So just quick aside, Mav and I both thought it was, you know, okay for Perez, but not necessarily amongst his best work. Brett goes on to say, it's vintage Perez, reminds me of one of his older Avengers covers, minus the word balloons. The action aside is great, a serious down and dirty fight between Diana and Silver Swan. Perez really sold the danger of the collapsing Ferris wheel. Seeing Steve catch that falling kid, all I could think was, oh man, his back. Mine hurt just reading the panel. Yeah, I'm right there with you, Brett. As a fellow old man, I ain't catching that kid. I'm like, sorry, kid, you'll heal fast. Kids bounce back. Pour some dirt on it. You'll walk it off. Commenting on a secret question from the episode, Brett goes on to say, favorite female villain, Madeline Pryor, of course. And no, not just because of the outfit. Okay, mostly the outfit. I'm right there with you, Brett. I freaking love Madeline Pryor. I loved her in the 80s. I loved her as a Claremont dame. I did not like the turn they had her take in Inferno. I didn't like that she was a clone. But I did love that they brought her back recently in the Krakoa era. And she's back out there. In fact, I think she's in charge of Limbo now, which is kind of cool. Brett goes on to say, based on Superman being my favorite hero and the longtime crush I had on Linda Carter's Wonder Woman, I was actually interested in seeing the two heroes hook up. Plus, at that point in the comics, John Byrne was writing Lois Lane as a mean lady with Webster's mom's hair who was always rude to Clark. I felt Supes could do better. So mark me down as one of those big stupid idiots. Hey, maybe I'm not smart enough to use the right fork for my salad or read Keats as a toddler, but darn it, I wanted those two crazy kids to take a chance on love. The result, meh, turns out he's better off with Zatanna. Superman and Zatanna, I don't see it at all, as I've said before. The fact that Lois Lane under Byrne is a mean woman with Webster's mom's hair is so damn funny, Brett, and is so true. If you go back and reread those early Byrne issues, she is, I mean, just almost intolerable. And you know, Stern and those guys will come along right after Byrne and not soften her up so much. She's still a tough-as-nails character, but just make it easier to understand why Clark falls in love. Up next is Nate the Great, who comments on the cover and secret question as well, saying, "The cover was like a triple for Perez. For anyone else, it would have been a home run, but this is the guy who did Crisis 7. At least we got a new female villain out of it. As for favorite female villain, it's got to be Harley Quinn, both the comic and Margot Robbie versions. Also, Brett's right. At the time this came out, John Byrne had kind of ruined Lois Lane. He should at least have had one fling with Wonder Woman." That's so funny, you guys. I had not thought about that iteration of Lois Lane in so long, and now it's all I can think about. Up next is Super Captain saying, "Good show this month. It's always interesting to hear from someone for whom studying comics is their actual job," referring to Christopher or to Dr. Maverick, who has a PhD in English, but a focus on studies, comic studies. "I think that I've mentioned before that I took a hiatus from buying and reading comics around the time that I graduated from high school. One reason was that our local newsstand closed in my small hometown, but another was the feeling that it was time to grow up and focus on more intellectual pursuits. I knew exactly one person in college who was reading comics. It was another 5 or 6 years before I picked up comics again while I was in grad school. They were my escape from the academic grind. I burned out on academia when I was in my doctoral program and dropped out early. Maybe if comics had been part of my field study, I would have stayed the course. Or maybe it would have burned out in comics, too." Yeah, it's so funny, Super Captain. Almost everybody I know has that story where they're like, "Oh yeah, I collected comics as a kid, and then I stopped when blank. Like, when I discovered girls, or boys, or when I went to high school, or when I went to college, and then I came back to it." I'm one of those rare weirdos who never gave up the habit, so, as my 100-plus long boxes will show. And so I don't have that same gap, but it's understandable. And, you know, like you, I've always used comics as a good escapism, and it's kept me sane. Super Captain goes on to say, "As far as favorite female villain goes, I have mentioned the Evil Queen from ABC's Once Upon a Time and Baroness from G.I. Joe. In comics, I lean towards Catwoman, Star Sapphire, and Diamondback. One name that I haven't seen mentioned is Mystique. I love the idea of an evil shape changer." Yeah, Mystique is such a great... She's almost an anti-hero sometimes, but really she's a villain, and she's better as a villain. That's a great call. Bringing us to a close, as always, is Bucky749, who asks, "Let's say Wonder Woman ended up in the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles universe. Who would we see her team up with?" I got to admit, Bucky, I'm not a big Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles guy. I don't know that mythology well. So I'm just going to go with Casey Jones. Not even because I understand who he is as a character, but just because I'm pretty sure he was played by David Boreanaz in the movie, and I love David Boreanaz ever since Buffy. So, you know, big shout out to him. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, everybody, who wrote in. Thanks to Dr. Christopher Maverick, who had been my guest on that episode. Thanks to Michael Bailey, who was my guest on this episode for Action 600. And keep listening, keep writing in. It's my favorite part of the show. And thank you so much for helping me bring a little bit of peace to man's world.